Guan said, for he knew he must go if it were true his father was so ill, although he doubted still and thought to himself that what his father said was true and women were all fools.
I will go, then. Rest here a day or two, my mother, before you come back, for you must be weary.
Then he made sure for her comfort, and saw her in the quiet room which seemed now his own, so that he left it sadly. And when she had eaten, he put from him the memory of the pleasant, lovely days, and, mounting on his horse once more, he turned his face to the north and to his father. And again he wondered at these two women, for they seemed too cheerful at his going, more cheerful than they should be if the lord of the house lay ill. Behind him went a score or so of his father's soldiers. Once, hearing them guffaw together at some coarseness, he could not bear them any more, and he turned on them in anger, hating the familiar clatter of them at his horse's heels. But when he asked them fiercely why they followed him, they answered sturdily,
"Sir, your father's trusty man bade us follow you lest some enemy take this chance and seize you for a ransom or even kill you. There are many robbers through the countryside, and you are an only precious son."
And Yuan answered nothing. He groaned and turned his face northwards steadily. What foolishness had made him think of freedom? He was his father's only son, most hopelessly his father's only son. And of the villagers and country folk who watched him passing, there was not one who was not rejected to see him go away again, because they did not understand him or believe in him at all. And Yuan could see their great content that he must go, and this sight remained a darkness in the pleasure of those free days. So Yuan rode against his will to his father's gates, the guard behind him. They did not leave him the whole way, and he soon perceived they guarded him not so much from robbers as from himself, lest he escape them somewhere. It was on his lips a score of times to cry at them,
"You need not fear me. I will not run from my own father. I come to him of my own will."
But he said nothing. He looked at them in scorn and silence and would not speak to them, but rode on as fast as he could, taking a haughty pleasure in his quick horse that kept so easily before their common ones that they must press their poor beasts on and on. Yet he knew himself a prisoner, however he might go. No verse came to him now. He scarcely saw the lovely land. At evening of the second day of this forced riding, he reached his father's threshold. He leaped from his horse, and suddenly weary to his very soul, he went slowly towards the room in which his father commonly slept, not heeding all the secret stares of soldiers and of serving men, and answering no greeting. But his father was not in his bed, although it was night by now, and a lounging guard said when Yuan asked him,
"The general is in his hall."
Then Yuan felt some anger, and he thought to himself that, after all, his father was not very ill, and it was only a ruse to win him home. He nursed his anger at the ruse, so that he would not fear his father, and when he remembered the pleasant, lonely days upon the land, he could keep his anger lively against his father. Yet when he entered the hall and saw the tiger, Yuan forgot some of his anger, for I could see here was no ruse. His father sat in his old chair, the tiger skin flung across the carved back of it, and before him was the glowing brazier full of coals. He was wrapped in his shaggy sheepskin robe, and on his head was set his high fur hat, but still he looked as cold as death. His skin was yellow as old leather, and his eyes burned dry and black and sunken, and the unshaved hair upon his face was gray and harsh. He looked up when his son came in, and then down again into the coals and gave no greeting. Then Yuan came forward and bowed before his father, saying,
"They told me you were ill, my father, so I came."
But Wang the tiger muttered,
"I am not ill. It is woman's talk."
And he would not look at his son. Then Yuan asked,
"Did you not send for me because you were ill?"
And Wang the tiger muttered again,
"I did not send for you. They asked me where you were, and I said, 'Let him stay where he is.'"
He looked down steadfastly into the coals and stretched his hands above their shimmering heat. Now these words might have angered anyone, and especially a young man in these days when parents are not honored, and Yuan might easily have hardened himself more and gone away again to do as he liked in his new willfulness. Except he saw his father's two hands stretched out, pale and dry as old man's hands are, and trembling and seeking for some warmth somewhere, and he could not say a word of anger. It came to him now, as the moment must come to any gentle-hearted son, that his father, in his loneliness, was grown a little child again, and one to be dealt with as a child, with tenderness and no anger, in whatever petulance he spoke. This weakness in his father struck at the roots of Yuan's anger, so that he felt unusual tears come to his eyes, and if he had dared, he would have put his hand out to touch his father, except some strange natural shame restrained him. Therefore he only sat down sideways on a chair nearby, and gazing at his father, waited silently and even patiently for what he might say next. But there was this freedom that the moment gave him. He knew his fear of his father was forever gone. Nevermore would he be afraid of this old man's roarings and his darkening looks and his black brows drawn down and all the tricks the tiger used to make himself fearful. For Yuan saw the truth, that these tricks were only weapons his father used. Though he had not known it, he had used them as a shield, or as men will take a sword and brandish it and never mean to bring it down on any flesh. So those tricks had covered the tiger's heart, which never had been hard enough, nor cruel enough, nor merry enough to make of him a truly great lord of war. In this moment, and its clearness, Yuan looked upon his father, and he began to love him fearlessly. But Wang the tiger, not knowing anything of this change in his son, sat brooding on, silent, and seeming to forget his son was there. He sat long without moving, and at last Yuan, seeing how ill his father's color was and how his flesh had dropped from him these last few days, so that the bones of his face stood out like rocks, said gently, "And would it not be better if you went to bed, my father?" When he heard his son's voice again, Wang the tiger looked up slowly as a sick man will, and he fixed his gaunt eyes upon his son and stared at him a while, and after another while he said hoarsely and very slowly, word for word, "For your sake once, I did not kill 173 men who deserved to die." He lifted his right hand, as though he would have held it over his mouth in a way he had. But the hand dropped of its own weight, and he let it hang, and he said to his son again, still staring at him, "It is true. I did not kill them for your sake." "I am glad, my father," said Yuan, moved not so much by the living men, although he was glad to know they lived, as by the childish longing he discerned in his father to please him. "I hate to see men killed, my father," he said.
I know it. You were always squeamish," answered Wang the tiger, listlessly,
and fell to silent staring at the coals again. Once more Yuan thought how to urge his father to his bed, for he could not bear the look of illness on his face and in the dry and drooping mouth. He rose and went to where the old trusty hair-lipped man sat on his haunches by the door, nodding as he sat, and whispered to him, "Cannot you persuade my father to his bed?" The man started up and staggered to his feet, awake at this, and answered hoarsely, "And have I never tried, my little general? I cannot persuade him even to go to his bed at night. If he lies down, he rises up again within an hour or so, and comes back to this chair to sit, and I can only sit here too. And I am so filled with sleep now, I am as good as dead. But there he sits, always awake." Then Yuan went to his father and coaxed him, and he said, "Father, I am weary too. Let us go and lie upon a bed and sleep, for I am so weary. I will lie near you, and you can call me and know that I am there." At this the tiger moved a little as though he would rise. Then he sank back and shook his head, and would not rise, and he said,
"No, I am not finished what I have to say. There is something else I cannot think of at all at once. Two things I counted on my right hand that I must say. Go sit somewhere and wait until my thought comes out."
The tiger spoke with his old vehemence now, and Yuan felt the habit of his childhood on him to go and sit. And yet there was this new fearlessness in him too, so that now his heart cried out against its duty.
"What is he but a very tiresome old willful man, and here must I sit and wait for his humors?"
And his willfulness shone out of his eyes, and almost he was about to speak when the trusty man saw him and hastened forward to coax him and said,
"Let him have his way, little general, since he is so ill, and bear what he says as we all must do."
So Yuan, against his will, yet fearing it might indeed make his father worse if he were opposed at such an hour, who never had known opposition, went and sat down sideways on a chair, and sat now less patiently until the tiger said suddenly,
"It has come back to me. The first thing is that I must hide you somewhere, for I remember what you told me when you came home yesterday. I must hide you from my enemies."
At this Yuan could not forbear crying out, "But, father, it was not yesterday." Then the tiger darted one of his old angry looks at his son, and he clapped his dry palms once together, and he cried,
"I know what I say. How was it not yesterday when you came home? You did come home yesterday."
And again the old trusty man stood between the tiger and his son, and called out pleadingly,
"Let be, let be, it was a yesterday."
And Yuan turned sullen, and hung his head because he must be silent. For now it was a strange thing, but the first pity he had for his father was gone, like a little quick mild wind passing over his heart, and these angry old looks his father gave him roused some deeper feeling in him than the pity. His resentments rose in him. He told himself he would not be afraid again, but he must be willful lest he be afraid. And in his own old willfulness, the father waited yet longer before he would speak on. He thought because he did not like his son to break into what he said, and so he waited longer than he would have otherwise. But the truth was, the tiger had something to say he did not like to say, and he waited. In that time of waiting, Yuan's anger against his father leaped up more strongly than it ever had. He thought of all the times he had been cowed to silence by this man, and he thought of all the hours he had spent at weapons which he hated, and he thought of his days of freedom cut off once more. And suddenly he could not bear the tiger. No, his very flesh shrank back from this old man, and he loathed his father suddenly because he was not washed or shaven, and because he had let his wine and food dribble down upon his robe. There was not anything about his father that he loved, at least for this moment. The tiger, not dreaming of all this hot loathing in his son's heart, went on at last with what he had to say, and it was this:
"But you are my only precious son. What hope have I except in your body? Your mother, for once, has said a wise thing. She came and said to me, 'And if he is not wed, from whence will come our grandsons?' I told her then, 'Go and search out a good hearty maid somewhere, and it does not matter what she is except she be lusty and quick to bear, for women are all alike, and one is not better than another. And bring her back and wed him, and then he can go out to hide in some foreign country until this war is over, and we shall have his seed.'"
This the tiger said very carefully, each word what he had thought before, and he gathered up his weary wits to do this duty for his son before he let him go. This was no more than any good father ought to do, and what every son must in reason expect. For any son should accept the wife so chosen for his parents' sake, and wed her and give her child, and then he is free to find his love elsewhere as he will. But Yuan was not a son like this. He was filled with the poison of new times, and full of secret willful freedoms that he did not know himself, and full, too, of his father's hatred against women. And what with his willfulness, he felt all his anger burst out of him now. Yes, his anger at this hour was like a checked flood in him, and all his life was gathered to its crisis now. At first he could not believe his father truly said these words, For all his life he had been so used to hear the tiger speak only of women as fools, or if not fools, then traitors and never to be trusted. But there the words were, spoken, and the tiger sat and stared into the coals as before. Now Yuan knew suddenly why his mother and her serving woman had been so eager secretly to get him home, and pleased when he made ready to return. For such women think of nothing but of matches and of weddings. Well, and he would not yield to them. He leaped up, forgetting that he ever had feared or loved his father, and he shouted, "I have waited for this. Yes, when my comrades told me how they were forced to marriage, and many of them left their homes for this very cause, I used to doubt my own good fortune. But you are like all the others, all these old people who would keep us tied forever, tied through our bodies, forcing us to the women you choose, forcing us to children. Well, I will not be tied. I will not have my body used like this to tie my life to yours. I hate you. I have always hated you. I know I hate you." Out of Yuan rushed such a stream of hatred now that he began to sob wildly, and the trusty man, in terror at such anger, ran and held him around the waist and would have spoken and could not, because his split lip was all awry. Yuan stared down and saw this man, and he was beside himself. He lifted up his hand and beat it down, clenched upon that old hideous face, so that the man lay felled to the floor. Now the tiger rose tottering, not to his son, no, he had stared in a daze at Yuan, as though he could not comprehend what these words were, his eyes dazed and staring. When he saw his old servant fall, he went to lift him up. But Yuan turned and fled. Not waiting once to see what was done, he ran through the courts and found his horse tied to a tree, and ran through the great outer gate and past the staring soldiers there, and leaped upon his horse and rode out of that place, and to himself he cried it was forever. Chapter 4. Now Yuan had run out of his father's house in wildest anger, and his anger must cool from its very heat, or he would die. And it did cool. He began to think what he could do, a lone young man who had cut himself away from comrades and from father. The very day helped him to coolness, for the winter sunshine, which seemed so endless in the days Yuan spent in the earthen house, now was not endless. The day was turned to grayness, and the wind blew from the east, very chill and bitter, and the land through which Yuan's horse went slowly, for the beast was wearied with the days of travel, turned gray too, and in its grayness Yuan felt himself swallowed up and cooled. The very people on the land took on this same grayness, for they were so like the earth upon which they lived and worked, that their looks changed with it, and their speech and all their movements quieted. Where in the sunshine their faces were live and often merry, now under the gray sky their eyes were dull and their lips unsmiling, and their garments dun-colored and their bodies slow. The little vivid colors of the land and hills, the blue of garments, the red of a child's coat, the crimson of a maiden's trousers, all these hues which commonly the sun would choose out and set alive, were now subdued. And Yuan, riding now through this dun country, wondered how he could have loved it so before. He might have turned back to his old captain and the cause, except he remembered the villagers and how they had not loved him, and these people whom he passed this day seemed so sullen that he cried to himself bitterly, "And shall I go and throw my life away for them?" Yes, on this day even the land seemed to him unsmiling. And as if that were not enough, his horse began to hobble, and when he descended near a certain small city that he passed, he found the beast stone-bruised and lame and useless. Now as Yuan had stopped and bent to look at the horse's hoof, he heard a great roaring noise, and he looked up, and there rushed past him a train, smoking mightily and full of haste. But still it did not pass too quickly for Yuan to see the many guests within, because he was so near and kneeling by his horse. There they sat, so warm and so secure, and thus went with such speed that Yuan envied them, and felt his own beast too slow and now useless, and he cried to himself, and it seemed to him a quick, clever thing to think. "I will sell this beast inside the city, and take that train and go far away, as far as I can." On that night he lay at an inn, a very filthy inn it was, inside that little city, and Yuan could not sleep, the vermin crawled so on him. And he lay awake, and while he lay, he planned what he could do. He had some money on him, for his father always made him wear a belt of money next his body, lest he be too short some time or other, and he had his horse to sell. But for a long time he could not think where he must go and what he must do. Now Yuan was no common and untutored lad. He knew old books of his own people, and he knew the new books of the West, for so his tutor had taught him. From his tutor, too, he had learned to speak very well a foreign tongue, and he was not helpless and untaught as he might have been. So while he tossed his body on the hard boards of that inn-bed, he asked himself what he should do with the silver that he had, and with his knowledge. To and fro in his own mind he asked himself if he had better go back to his captain. He could go and say, "I have repented, take me back." And if he told that he had left his father and struck down the trusty man, it would be enough, since among this band of revolutionists it was a passport if a parent were defied, and always proof of loyalty, so that some of these young, both men and women, even killed their parents to show their loyalty. But Yuan, even though he knew he would be welcome, somehow did not want to go back to that cause. The memory of the gray day was still melancholy in him, and he thought of the dusty common people, and then he did not love them. He muttered to himself, "I have never in all my life long had any pleasure. All the little joys that other young men have I have not had. My life has been filled with my duty to my father, and then this cause I could not follow." And suddenly he thought he would like some life he had not yet seen, a merrier life, a life with laughter in it. It seemed to Yuan suddenly that all his life he had been grave and without playmates, and yet there must be pleasure somewhere as well as work to do. When he thought of play, he remembered into his very early childhood, and he thought of that younger sister he once knew, and how she used to laugh and patter here and there upon her little feet, and how he used to laugh when he was with her. Well, and why should he not seek her out again? She was his sister. They were one blood. He had been so knotted into his father's life all these long years that he had forgotten he had others to whom he belonged. Suddenly he saw them all in his mind. He had a score of kinfolk. He might go to his uncle, Wang the merchant. For a moment he thought it might be pleasant to be in that house again, and he saw in his memory a hearty, merry face which was his aunt's, and he thought of his aunt and of his cousins. But then he thought willfully, no, he would not go so near his father, for his uncle surely would tell his father, and it was too near. He would take the train and go far away. His sister was far away, very far in the coastal city. He would like to live a while in that city, and see his sister and take pleasure in the merry sights, and see all the foreign things he had heard of and never seen. His heart hurried him. Before dawn came, he rose leaping up and shouted for the servant in the inn to fetch him hot water to wash himself, and he took off his clothes and shook them well to rid them of the vermin. And when the man came, he cursed him for such filth and was all eagerness to be gone. When the serving man saw Yuan's impatience, he knew him for a rich man's son, for the poor dare not curse so easily, and he grew obsequious and made haste. And so by dawn Yuan was fed and off, leading his red horse to sell. This poor beast he sold for very little at a butcher's shop. A moment's pang Yuan had, it is true, for he shrank a little to think his horse must be turned into food for men, but then he hardened himself against this softness. He had no need for horses now. He was no longer a general's son. He was himself, Wang Yuan, a young man free to go where he would and do what he liked. And that very day he mounted into the train that took him to the great coastal city. It was a lucky thing for Yuan that he had sometimes read to his father the letters which the tiger's learned wife sent him from that coastal city where she had gone to live. The tiger, as he was older, grew more indolent about reading anything, so that, although as a youth he had read very well, in his age he had forgotten many letters, and did not read with ease. Twice a year the letters came from this lady to her lord, and she wrote a very learned sort of writing which was not easy to read, and Yuan read the letters to his father and explained them. Now, remembering, he could remember where she said she lived, in what street and in what part of that great city. So when, at the end of a day and a night, Yuan came down off that train, having crossed a river on the way and skirted by a lake or two, and passed through many mountains and through much good, planted land, whereon the spring wheat was sprouting, he knew where he must go. It was not very near to where he was, and so he hired a rickshaw to pull him there. And thus he went through the lighted city streets alone and to his own adventure. And as he went, he stared about him as freely as any farmer might, since no one knew him. Never had he been in such a city as this was, for the houses rose so high on the sides of the streets that even with all the blazing lights he could not see their tops, which ended somewhere in the darkness of the sky. But at the foot of the towering houses where Yuan was, it was bright enough, and the people walked as though in the light of day. He saw the people of the world here, for they were of every race and kind and color. He saw black men from India, and their women wrapped about with cloth of gold, and with pure white muslin, and with scarlet robes to set off their dark beauty. And he saw the swift-moving shapes of white women, and their men with them all dressed the same always, and all their noses long, so that Yuan looked at these men, wondering how these women told their husbands from other men. They looked so much the same, except some were big-bellied or hairless on their scalps, or had some other such lack in beauty. Still, most of the people were his own kind, and Yuan saw every sort of countrymen of his upon these streets. There were the rich, who came riding in great machines to the door of some pleasure house, and they drove up with the great shrieking noise of horns, and Yuan's rickshaw man must draw aside and wait until they passed, as in the old days kings might have passed. Where the rich were, there were the poor beside them, the beggars and the maimed and the diseased who made such of their woes to gain a little silver. But it was hardly gained, and the silver leaked from the purses of the rich in very small, scanty pieces, for usually the rich passed on their way, their noses high and their eyes unseeing. In all his eagerness for pleasure, Yuan could feel a moment's hatred of these haughty rich, and he thought they ought to give a little to the beggars. Through all this moving multitude, Yuan went obscure enough in his humble vehicle, until a man stopped panting before a certain gate set in a long wall, and like a score of other gates on either side. This was the place Yuan sought, and so he came down and fetched out the coins he had promised to the man and gave them to him. Now Yuan had seen with indignation how little those rich men and ladies had heeded the cries of the beggars, and how they had pushed past the scrawny hands thrust out before them. Yet when this working man cried humbly, trembling and sweating with his running, "Sir, add a little out of the kindness of your heart," for he had noted Yuan's robe of silk and his well-fed looks, it did not seem the same thing to Yuan at all. He did not feel himself rich, and it is known that these men who pull at rickshaws never are content. So he cried stoutly, "Is not the price agreed?" And the man answered, sighing, "Oh, aye, it is the price agreed, but I thought from your kind heart." But Yuan had forgotten the man. He turned to the gate and pressed a bell he saw there. Then the man, seeing himself forgotten, sighed again and wiped his hot face with a filthy cloth he had about his neck, and wandered down the street, shivering in the keen night wind, which turned his sweat to ice upon his flesh. When the man-servant came to open the gate, he stared at Yuan as at a stranger, and for a while would not let him in, because in that city there were many well-dressed strangers who rang at gates, and said they were friends and relatives of those who lived there, and when they were bidden to come in they drew out foreign guns, and robbed and killed and did what they would. And sometimes their fellows came and helped them, and they seized a child or man, and took him away to hold for ransom. So the servant quickly barred the gate again, and although Yuan cried out what his name was, there he must wait a while. Then once more the gate opened, and this time he saw a lady there, a quiet, grave-faced lady, large and white-haired, her robe of some dark plum-hued satin. Yuan looked at her as she looked at him, and he saw her face was kind, a full, pale face, not wrinkled much, but never beautiful, since the mouth was too large and the nose large and flat between the eyes. Still, the eyes were kind and comprehending, and Yuan took courage, and he smiled a little in shyness, and he said,
"I need to ask your pardon that I come like this, lady, but I am Wang Yuan, the tiger's son, and I have left my father. I ask nothing from you except, since I am alone, that I may come in and see you and my sister."
The lady had been looking at him very closely as he spoke, and she said mildly, "I could not believe the man when he said it was you. It has been so long since I saw you that I would not know you, except you are so like your father. Yes, none could fail to see you are the tiger's son. Come in, then, and be at home." And though the servant looked still doubtful, the lady urged Yuan to come in, and she was so mild and placid that she seemed not surprised at all, or in truth as though anything on this earth could surprise her now. No, she led him into a narrow hall, and then she bade the servant make a room ready with a bed in it, and asked Yuan if he had eaten, and she opened a door into a guest hall, and asked him to be seated there, and at his ease, while she went to fetch certain things for his comfort in the room the servant made ready for him. All this she did so easily and with such ready welcome that Yuan was pleased and warmed, and felt himself a welcome guest at last, and this was very sweet to him, wearied as he was with what had come about between his father and himself. In this guest hall he sat himself down upon an easy chair and waited wondering, for it was not such a room as he had ever seen, but as his way was, showing no wonder or excitement on his grave face. He sat quietly, wrapped in his long robe of dark silk, looking a little about the room, yet looking not so much that if one came in he would be surprised at such a thing, for he was of a nature which hated to seem strange or ill at ease in any new place. It was a small, square room, and very clean, so clean that on the floor a flowered woolen cloth was spread, and even this had no soil upon it. In the center of this cloth a table stood, and on the table another cloth of red velvet, and in this center a pot of pink paper flowers, very real to see, except the leaves were silver and not green. There were six chairs, such as the one he sat on, soft in the seat and covered with pink satin. At the windows were hung white strips of fine cloth, and on the wall was hung a picture of a foreign sort behind a pane of glass. This picture showed high mountains very blue, a lake as blue, and on the mountains foreign houses, such as he had not seen. It was very bright and pretty to the eye. Suddenly a bell rang somewhere, and Yuan turned his head to the door. He heard quick footsteps, and then a girl's voice, high and full of laughter. He listened. It could be perceived she spoke to someone, although he heard no answering voice, and many words she used he scarcely understood, ripples interspersed of some foreign tongue. "Ah, is it you? No, I am not busy. Oh, I am tired today. I danced so late last night. You are teasing me. She is much prettier than I. You laugh at me. She dances much better than I do. Even the white man want to dance with her. Yes, it is true I did dance with a young American. Ah, how he can dance. I will not tell you what he said. No, no, no. Then I will go with you tonight. 10 o'clock. I will have dinner first." He heard a pretty rill of laughter, and suddenly the door opened and he saw a girl there, and he rose to bow, his eyes dropped down in courtesy, avoiding a direct look at her. But she ran forward swiftly, graceful as a darting swallow and as quick, her hands outstretched. "You are my brother, Yuan," she cried, gaily in her little soft voice, a voice high and floating seemingly upon the air. "My mother said you were here all of a sudden." She seized his hands and laughed. "How old-fashioned you are in that long robe.
Shake hands like this. Everybody shakes hands now.
He felt her small, smooth hand seize his, and he pulled his own away, too shy to bear it, staring at her while he did it. She laughed again and sat down on the arm of a chair and turned her face up at him, the prettiest little face, three-cornered as a kitten's, the black hair smooth and curled upon her rounded cheeks. But it was her eyes that held him, the brightest, blackest eyes, shot through with light and laughter. And beneath them was her red little mouth, the lips very full and red and yet small and delicate.
"Sit down,"
she cried, a little imperious queen. He sat then very carefully upon the edge of a chair, not near her, and she laughed again.
"I am Ilan,"
she went on in her light, fluttering voice.
"Do you remember me?
I remember you so well, only you have grown up better than you were. You used to be an ugly little boy, your face so long. But you must have some new clothes. All my cousins wear foreign clothes now. You would look nice in them, so tall. Can you dance? I love to dance. Do you know our cousins? My eldest cousin's wife dances like a fairy. You should see my old uncle. He'd like to dance, but he is so old and hugely fat, and my aunt won't let him. You should see him when she scolds him for staring at pretty girls." Again she laughed her restless, flying laughter. Yuan stole a look at her. She was slighter than any creature he had ever seen, as small as any child about the body, and her green silk robe fitted as tightly to her as a calyx to a bud, the collar high and close about her slender neck, and in her ears were little rings of pearls and gold. He looked away and coughed a little behind his hand.
"I came to pay my respects to our mother and to you," he said.
She smiled at this, mocking his sedateness, a smile that set her face twinkling, and she rose and went to the door, her step so swift it seemed like a light running.
"I'll go and find her, brother," she said, making her voice solemn to mock his.
Then she laughed again and flung a teasing look at him from out her black kitten's eyes. The room was very quiet with her going, as though a little busy wind had suddenly ceased to blow in it. Yuan sat astonished, not able to comprehend this girl. She was not like anyone he had ever seen in all his soldier's life. He set his brain to remember how she was when they were small together before his father made him leave his mother's court. He remembered this same swiftness, this prattle, this darting of her great black eyes. He remembered, too, how dull his days had seemed at first without her, how lifeless were his father's courts. Remembering it, even now this room seemed too quiet and lonely, and he wished she would come back to it, and he was eager to see her more, because he wanted more of laughter like hers. Suddenly he thought again how his whole life long had been without laughter, always filled with a duty of some kind or other, and how he had never play and merriment such as any poor child has upon the street, and such as any crowd of laboring men has if they stop a moment to rest in the sunshine of noon and eat their food together. His heart beat a little quickly. What had the city for him? What laughter, and what gaiety such as all young men must love? What new, shining life! When the door sounded again, therefore, he looked eagerly towards it, but now it was not Ilan. It was the lady, and she came in quietly, and as one who made her house ready and full of good ease and comfort for all. Behind her came the serving man bearing on a tray some bowls of hot food, and she said, "Set the food here. Now, Yuan, you must eat a little more if you would please me, for I know the food upon the trains is not like this. Eat, my son, for you are my son, Yuan, since I have had no other. And I am glad you have sought me out, and I want you to tell me everything and how you are come here." When Yuan heard this good lady speak kindly, and when he saw her face honest in its look and meaning, and when he heard her comfortable voice, and saw the inviting look her little mild eyes had when she put a chair for him beside a table, he felt foolish tears come to his eyes. Never, he thought passionately within himself, had such gentle welcome been made for him anywhere. No, No one was so kind to him as this. Suddenly the warmth of this house, the gayness of the colors of the room, the remembered laughter of Ilon, the comfort of this lady, rose up and wrapped him round. He ate eagerly, for he found himself very hungry, and the food was seasoned carefully, and not scant of fat or sauces, as foods are when they are bought. And Yuen, forgetting how once he had eaten eagerly of country fare, thought now this was the best, most heartening food he ever ate, and he ate his fill. Yet he was quickly satisfied, because the dishes were so fat and highly seasoned, and he could eat no more in spite of all the lady's urging. When it was over and the lady waited while he ate, she bade him sit in the easy chair again, and then warmed and fed and comforted, Yuen told her everything, and even things he scarcely knew himself. Now he met the lady's gaze, a full, waiting gaze, and suddenly his shyness dropped from him, and he began to speak and tell her all he wanted, how he had hated war, and how he wanted to live upon the land, not ignorantly, as the peasants did, but as a wise husbandman, one learned enough to teach the peasants better ways. And he told how, for his father's sake, he ran from his captain secretly, and now in some new understanding of himself those wise eyes gave him while they rested on him, he said, troubled, "I thought I ran because I would not go against my father, but now, as I tell it, lady, I see I went partly because I hate the killing my comrades must do some day, even in their good cause. I cannot kill. I am not brave, I know. The truth is, I cannot hate wholly enough to kill a man. I always know how he feels, too." He looked at the lady humbly, ashamed to show his weakness. But she answered tranquilly, "Not everyone can kill, it's true. Else would we all be dead, my son." And after a while she said more kindly still, "I am glad you cannot kill, Yuen. It is better to save life than take it, and so I think, although I serve no Buddhist god." But it was not until he told, haltingly and half-ashamed, how the tiger would have him wed anyhow to any maid, that the lady was fully moved. Until now she had listened to him kindly and full of comprehension, murmuring small assents now and then when he waited for a moment. But when he hung his head and said, "I know he has the right to do it. I know the law and customs, but I could not bear it. I cannot. I cannot. I must have my body for my own and free." And then, troubled by his own memory of his hatred against his father, and needing to confess it somehow, he said further, for he wanted to tell everything, "Almost I understand how sons kill their fathers in these days. Not that I could really do it, but I understand the feeling in those with a readier hand than mine." He looked at the lady to see if this were too hard for her to bear, but it was not. She said with a new force and with more certainty than she had yet spoken, "You are right, Yuen. Yes, I always tell the parents of the youth nowadays, the fathers and the mothers of Ilon's friends, and even your uncle and his lady, who complain unceasingly against this generation, that in this, at least, the young are right. Oh, I know very well how right you are. I will never force Ilon to any marriage, and I will help you, if need be, against your father in this thing, for here I am sure you are truly right." This she said sadly, but with some secret passion gathered from her own life, and Yuen wondered to see her small, quiet eyes change and sparkle so, and her whole placid face grow moved. But he was too young to think long of any other than himself, and the comfort of her words joined to the comfort of this quiet house, and he said longingly, "If I could stay here for a while, until I can see what I must do." "And so you shall," she answered warmly. "You shall stay here as long as you have need. I have ever wanted a son of my own, and here you are." The truth was, the lady suddenly loved this tall, dark youth, and she liked the big, honest look upon his face, and she liked the slow way he moved. And though he might not be pretty by the measure of the usual guess, being too high-cheeked and his mouth too big, still he was taller than most young men are, and she liked a certain shyness and a delicacy he had about him when he spoke, as though even if he were willful, he was not too sure of his own abilities. Yet this delicacy was only in his speech, for his voice was deep and good and a man's voice. And Yuan saw her liking, and was yet more warmed by it, and it made this house his home. When they had talked a little more, she led him to a small room which was to be his own. It was up a stair, and then up another smaller winding stair, and under the roof it stood, clean and with all the things he needed. When she was gone and he was alone, he went and looked out of the window, and there was the light upon the many streets, and all the city lay glittering and shining, and in the high darkness he seemed looking into a new heaven of some sort. Chapter 5. Now began for Yuan a new life indeed, a full new life such as he had never dreamed for himself. In the morning when he rose and washed and clothed himself, he went down the stairs, and there the lady waited for him, and she had her same beaming look this morning to set him at fresh ease. She led Yuan into where the breakfast was upon the table, and at once she began to tell him what her plans were for him, but always very carefully too, so that she might not say a thing against his will. First, she said, she must buy him some garments, since he came forth in only what he had upon him, and then she must send him to a school for young men in that city. She said, "There is no great haste, my son, for you to work. It is better in these days to have your fill of this new learning, or else what you will earn will be very little. Let me treat you as my son. Let me give you what I had planned for Ailan, if she would have had it. You shall go to this school here until it is clear what your place is in your books, and when you are finished here, then you may work, or you may even go to some foreign country for a while. Nowadays the young men and women are all zealous to go abroad, and I say it is a good thing for them to go. Yes, though your uncle cries out it is a waste, and that they all come back too full of their own skill and abilities, so that there is no living with them, I say still it is well for them to go and learn what they can, and come back, and give it to their own country. I only wish Ailan—" Here the lady stopped, and looked sorrowful for a while, and as though she had forgotten what she spoke of, because of some inner trouble of her own. Then she made her face clear again, and said resolutely, "I must not try to shape Ailan's life. If she will not, then she will not, and do not let me shape you either, son. I only say that if you would, if you will, why, then I can think of a way to do it." Now Yuan was so dazed at all this newness that he could scarcely take it all into him, and he stammered forth joyfully, "Be sure, I can only thank you, lady, and I do most gladly what you say." And he sat down, and in his young new hunger, and in all the joyfulness of a heart at rest and a place to be his home, he ate a mighty breakfast, and the lady laughed and was pleased, and said, "I swear I am glad you are come, Yuan, if for nothing else, then that I shall see you eat, for Ailan is so fearful lest she put a little flesh upon her bones, she dares not eat at all, scarcely, and not more than a kitten does, and she will not rise from her bed in the morning, lest seeing food she crave it. She cares for beauty more than for anything, that child of mine, but I like to see the young eat." So saying, she took her own chopsticks and searched out the best bits of the fish and fowl and condiments for Yuan, and took far greater pleasure in his healthy hunger than in anything she ate herself. So began Yuan's new life. First this lady went out to great shops of silks and woolen stuffs sent from the foreign countries, and she called tailors to the house, and they cut and measured all the stuffs and made robes for Yuan, according to the city fashions. And the lady hastened them, because Yuan still had his old robes on, and they were cut too wide and in a country style, and she would not let him go to see his uncle and cousins while he wore them. And when they heard he was come, for be sure Ailan must tell them that he was there, they bid him come to a feast of welcome. But the lady held them off a day until his best robe was finished, a robe of satin peacock blue, and flowered in the same color, and a short jacket, sleeved, of black satin. And Yuan was glad she did, for when he clothed himself in the new garment and had called a city barber to come and cut his hair, and shave the young soft hairs from off his face, and when he had put on his feet the new leather shoes the lady bought for him, and had drawn on the black short silken jacket, and put on his head a foreign hat of felt such as every young man wore, he could not but know, as he stared into the mirror on the wall in his own room, that he looked a very fine young man. And like all the young men in the city, and it was only nature to be glad of this. Yet this very knowledge made him shamefaced, and he went down very shyly to the room where the lady waited for him, and Eilon was there too, and she clapped her hands to see him, and cried out, "Ah, you are a very beautiful young man now, Yuen." And she laughed so teasingly that Yuen felt the blood rush up to make his face and neck red, so that he laughed again. But the lady rebuked her mildly, and turned him about to see that all was right, and it was, and she was pleased again with him. Because his body was so straight and strong, it paid her to see how well her pains were rewarded in his better looks. On the second day after this one the feast was set, and Yuen went with his sister and with the lady whom already he called mother, and the word came to his tongue more easily than it did for his own mother somehow, to his uncle's house. They went in a vehicle not drawn by horses, but forced by an engine in its vitals and driven by a serving man, and Yuen had never sat in such a thing before. But he liked it very well because it ran as smoothly as though it went on ice. While they went and before they ever reached his uncle's house, Yuen knew much about his uncle and his aunts and cousins, for Eilon chattered of them, telling this thing and another, laughing as she told, and with such sly looks and twistings of her little round red mouth as added point to every word. And as she talked, Wang Yuen could see the very pictures of their kin, and in spite of his decorum, he laughed. She was so witty and so mischievous. He saw his uncle, as she told him off, "A very mountain of a man, Yuen, holding such a paunch before him, I swear he needs to grow another leg to carry it on, and jowls down to his shoulders, and bald as any priest. But far from any priest, Yuen, and only sore against his fat, because he cannot dance as his sons do, though how he thinks to clasp a maid and have her near him." At such a thought, the maid burst into laughter, and her mother cried out mildly, but her eyes twinkled too. "Eilon, take care of your words, my child, he is your uncle."
"Yes, and so I say what I like," she answered pertly. "And my aunt Yuen, his first lady, she hates it here and longs to go back to the country, and yet she fears to leave him lest some maid catch him for his money, and being modern will not be his concubine but his true wife, and so push her to one side. His two ladies join in this one thing at least. They will not let him take a third, a sort of women's league these days, Yuen. And my three cousins, well, the eldest is wed, as you know, and my cousin's wife is the man there and rules him furiously, so that my poor cousin must take his pleasure all secretly, and then she is so clever that she smells a new perfume on him, or finds a dash of powder on his coat, or hunts his pockets for a letter, and he is his own father over again. And our second cousin, Sheng, he is a poet, a pretty poet, and he writes verses for the magazines and stories about death for love, and he is a rebel of a sort, a gentle, pretty, smiling rebel, always newly in some love. But our third cousin is the real rebel, Yuen. He's a revolutionist. I know he is." At this, her mother cried out in earnest, "Eilon, be careful what you say. Remember, he is our kin, and that word is dangerous in this city in these days." "He told me so himself," said Eilon. But she put her voice low and glanced at the man's back who drove the vehicle. So much she said, and much more, and when Wang Yuen went in his uncle's house, he knew each one there because of what his sister said. It was a different house indeed from the great house Wang Lung had bought and left his sons in that old northern country town. That house was aged and great, and the rooms were vast and deep and dark, or small and dark and set about the courts, and there was no upper story to it, but room upon room sprawled out, and the space was plenty, and the roofs were high and beamed and old, and the windows latticed with a sort of shell sent from the south. But this new house in this new foreign city stood in a street with others like it, which pressed hard against it. They were foreign houses, tall, high, narrow, without a single court or garden,
and the rooms were close together, small, and very bright with many glass windows without lattices. The sunlight poured into the rooms, hard and shining and lightening every hue and color on the walls or on the flowered, satin-covered chairs and tables, and the bright silks of women's clothes and the vermilion of their painted lips, so that when Yuan entered the room where all his kinfolk were, he felt a glitter there which was too much for beauty. Now his uncle rose, his hands lifting his huge belly from his knees, and from it his brocaded robes hung down like curtains, and he gasped out to greet his guests. "Well, sister-in-law, and my brother's son and Ailan! Well, this Yuan is a great tall black lad, too, like his father. Not like, no, I swear, gentler than a tiger, somewhat, perhaps." He laughed his rolling, gasping laugh, and heaved himself into a seat again, and his lady rose, and Yuan, looking sideways, saw her a neat, gray-faced lady, very plain and proper in her black satin coat and skirt, her hands crossed into her sleeves, and her little bound feet holding her unsteadily. She gave greeting to them, and she said, "I hope I see you well, sister-in-law, and brother's son. Ailan, you are grown thin, too thin. These maids nowadays will starve themselves and wear their little straight-cut dresses that are bold as men's robes. Pray, sit down, sister." Near her stood a woman Yuan did not know at all, a woman with a scrubbed rosy face, her skin shining with soapy washing and her hair down straight from her brow in a country fashion, and her eyes very bright, but not too wise. No one thought to say this woman's name, and Yuan did not know if she were a servant or not, until his lady mother said a kind greeting to her, and from it Yuan knew this was his uncle's concubine. He moved his head a little then, and the woman blushed and bowed as country women will, her hands folded in her sleeves, but she said nothing. Then, when greetings were all given, the cousins called out to Yuan to come and drink his tea aside in another room with them, and he and Ailan did, glad to be free of their elders. And Yuan sat silently and heard the chatter of those who know each other well,